True, there are revolts against bourgeois ideology. This is what one generally calls the avant-garde. But these revolts are socially limited. They remain open to salvage. First, because they come from a small section of the bourgeoisie itself, from a minority group of artists and intellectuals without public other than the class which they contest, and who remain dependent on its money in order to express themselves. Then, these revolts always get their inspiration from a very strongly made distinction between the ethically and the politically bourgeois. What the avant-garde contests is the bourgeois in art or morals. But as for political contestation, there is none. What the avant-garde does not tolerate about the bourgeoisie is its language, not its status. This does not necessarily mean that it approves of this status. Simply, it leaves it aside. Whatever the violence of the provocation, the nature it finally endorses is that of the derelict man, not the alienated man. And the derelict man is still eternal man. This is from Roland Barthes' essay, Myth Today. So on one level, the exhibition Parapolitics is grappling with the relationship between artistic autonomy, modernist abstraction, and the extrajudicial realm of covert state craft operations. The bush of ghosts in the title of the conference, which Ansem spoke about in his introduction yesterday as well, refers to a wild zone of power, both actual political power and symbolic or semantic power. The conceptual proposition we are making in our attempt to frame this rather unwieldy terrain of Cold War cultural politics with all its subversions and counter-subversions of meaning, on one level, meaning and images, at least for the purpose of this conference, and this is a proposition that I want to suggest that we consider together to A, see if it holds up, and B, see what it can open up. And the proposition is that this wild zone of power, this bush of ghosts, refers not only to the extrajudicial realm of covert state craft operations, but also to modernist abstraction, which, let's say, seems to have claimed for itself the freedom or the power not to refer to reality, or not to have to account for reality. Another quote, just to kind of contextualize the wild zone of power, which I think we're referencing Susan Buck-Moore's Dream World and Catastrophe, which was quite important for us. And I quote, from the perspective of the end of the 20th century, the paradox seems irrefutable that political regimes claiming to rule in the name of the masses, claiming that is to be radically democratic, construct legitimately a terrain in which the exercise of power is out of the control of the masses, veiled from public scrutiny, arbitrary and absolute. Modern sovereignties harbor a blind spot, a zone in which the power is above the law, and thus, at least potentially, a terrain of terror. This wild zone of power, by its very structure, is impossible to domesticate. It is intrinsic to mass democratic regimes. It makes no difference whether the model of their legitimacy is a liberal claim of political formal democracy based on universal mass suffrage or the socialist claims of economic substantive democracy based on the egalitarian distribution of social goods. Either way, as regimes of supreme sovereign power, they are always already more than a democracy and consequently a good deal less. So according to Buck-Moore, there cannot be a democratic regime without this wild zone of power, or a democratic regime would not be democratic without this wild zone of power. And at least insofar as it is a condition of the very existence of democratic regimes, this wild zone of power, according to her proposition, cannot be domesticated. It is always there, and it is always susceptible to turning into this terrain of terror. So now this begs the question, can the wild zone of power in modernist abstraction be domesticated? And if it can be domesticated, then perhaps we have been too quick in this conceptual formulation in bringing these things, modernist abstraction and extrajudicial operations, into relation. In what we have been talking about yesterday, and I think we'll do much more of today, modernism was domesticated during the Cold War, perhaps even by the Cold War. One of the things that could be said about early modernism which was comprised of many and multiple and extremely disparate positions and movements, was that it refused meaning, any easy attachment to meaning. It had no fixed cultural or political meaning. And the argument is often made in Greg Barnicell's Cold War Modernism. It was precisely because early modernism had no fixed cultural or political meaning that it could be transfigured or occupied or borrowed for the anti-communist cause. While the early avant-gardes were anti-bourgeois, even if not entirely, at least to the extent that Barthes suggested they in fact were, late modernism became the opposite, a pro-Western, pro-freedom, and pro-bourgeois movement, a weapon. Its artistic language was co-opted and served up as evidence of the superiority of the Western way of life. So that is to say, according to all the arguments we seem to be making, modernism went from becoming a movement to a style and basically got domesticated. At the same time, what does it mean that it is modernism's relentless pursuit of the new for its own sake that made it free for all, made it something that could be occupied and appropriated by the coming hegemony? There seems to be both an opening and a closure in such a kind of conception, and I guess I'm holding out in relation to this question of whether what this domestication kind of means for us and what this in turn means for the question of artistic autonomy. In a recent conversation about this project with Akhil Bilgrami, who is a professor of philosophy at Columbia, he said to me that Martin Luther was right about belief. That is, by virtue of what belief is, it cannot be coerced. I think Akhil was reminding me, you know, in all our discussions about cultural propaganda and psychological warfare and this kind of like management of meaning, that there is still something, this thing called belief, and of course we can think about the relationship between belief, art, and autonomy, but that this thing called belief or what we believe, that is still out of reach.
So we are happy to introduce Alessandro Valteo Jasbeck. He's based in Berlin. Alessandro interrogates history in his practice as well as narratives of art. He researches in archives, he quotes, he reproduces. You would see in Parapolitics several of his works. By reproducing, he interrogates the very history of these objects and these agents, making also a meta-narrative, as we discussed yesterday with the technical assistant of the Museum of Modern Art. Today, Alessandro will do something unusual. He will share the third part of a project, Chronoscope, that is in process. He will share his archives in a kind of lecture performance, where he will comment each section of the footage that he later will edit as the third part of this Chronoscope. Chronoscope was a program of the Cold War that was broadcast in a CBS network from 1951 to 1955. You will see how this program featured US politicians, diplomats, foreign leaders, and corporate executives. This chapter of Chronoscope that we will somehow premiere here in its raw nature will focus on propaganda that deals very closely with the questions of the exhibition Parapolitics. Let's welcome Alessandro.